Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on China. Nick Sheridan, one of our members, suggested that we do this talk tonight. So I should introduce our speaker briefly. Chris Chappell has a master's from New York University. He then moved into journalism, focusing on China, and in the last 6 years has produced China Uncensored, the television program that appears on cable TV and online in the United States. And so the topic for tonight's talk is China's growing influence on the West and its politics. Chris Chappell, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Let me just set my water over here by sensitive electrical equipment. I hope that's fine. All right. Hi. Welcome to the Sydney Institute. I'm your speaker, Chris Chappell. Thank you. For the last 6 years, I've hosted an American TV show called China Uncensored. We use humor to talk about what's happening in China and how that affects the world. In the time that we've talked about China, we've covered enough topics to fill about 1,000 episodes. But since I only have half an hour tonight, I've decided to cut it down to just the terrifying highlights. China's influence in the West is growing. And the Chinese Communist Party that rules China with an iron fist is using Australia and New Zealand to test out tactics they plan to use around the world to influence politics and undermine democratic societies. The New York Times says, quote, China has long treated Australia as a laboratory for soft power experiments. That's right. China chose you to experiment on. Congratulations. And that's why I've made the trip here from New York. But what does this all mean? Well, tonight I'm going to give you a little insight into the Chinese Communist Party, and I'll talk about how they wage what they call unrestricted warfare against Western countries, including Australia. All countries want influence. But the Chinese Communist Party is different, both in methods and goals. If we hope to understand this, we need to understand the nature of the Chinese Communist Party, because it operates in a fundamentally different way than any other government in the world. Historically, China was an incredibly powerful, influential country, not just in Asia, even as far away as ancient Rome. A Roman statesman, Pliny the Elder, in his book Natural Histories, complained about the trade deficit Rome had with China because the Romans had an insatiable appetite for Chinese silk. So, for 2,000 years, the West has been complaining about the trade deficit with China, from Pliny the Elder to President Donald Trump. It wasn't just trade. People have always been inspired by Chinese culture. All you have to do is take a look at European attempts to imitate Chinese art in the 17th and 18th centuries. Yeah, back in the day, it was the West making cheap knockoffs of Chinese products. People would look at a vase and say, made in France. Ugh. Of course, in the modern era, China's prestigious position in the world changed after centuries of warfare, economic turmoil, and colonialism. And then, in 1949, the Communist Party liberated China. It liberated people from their land, their wealth, and in many cases, their lives. Mao Zedong launched a systematic campaign to annihilate traditional Chinese culture and replace it with the culture of the Communist Party, a culture of struggle. Under Mao Zedong, violent struggle became the cornerstone of Chinese society. Children against parents, wives against husbands, students against teachers, and of course, communism against the free world. It's been a long time since Mao. On the surface, it seems like China has changed. There are no more Red Guards. In Shanghai, you can pay for your Big Mac on your iPhone on the way to the next Avengers movie. But behind it all, the Chinese Communist Party is still there, and it controls the government, the courts, and even business. And unlike other bad parties, this one you can't leave. And if you try, things can get unpleasant pretty fast. The Chinese Communist Party has not fundamentally changed. It's still an authoritarian state that attempts to control every aspect of society, including the economy. It maintains its philosophy of struggle, and its war against the free world has never ended. That's not me saying that. That is top Chinese military leaders openly saying that. In 1999, two colonels from the People's Liberation Army, or PLA, coined the term unrestricted warfare. In fact, they wrote a book called Unrestricted Warfare. It describes how a country like China could rival the West. They said, "The first rule of unrestricted warfare is that there are no rules, with nothing forbidden, like after hours at a bar in King's Cross. Unrestricted warfare is a war without a single shot fired." The PLA says the struggle for victory will take place on a battlefield beyond the battlefield. But the goal is the same as any war. The Chinese Communist Party wants to become the world's primary superpower and primary influence on other nations. I hope you like Chinese food. But seriously, for a regime that's secretive about everything, from pollution data to state executions to even basic economic data, they've been surprisingly transparent about their goal to become a superpower. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has openly spoken about it. Again, all countries want influence. But remember, the Chinese Communist Party is not a normal government. The Australian Security Intelligence Organization, ASIO, recently revealed they consider the Chinese Communist Party an extreme threat, and the level of espionage and foreign interference in Australia is worse now than at the height of the Cold War, which, if you've forgotten, was not a pleasant time. The Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare has several components. Today I'm going to focus on how unrestricted warfare uses propaganda and censorship, economic interests, and political and academic infiltration. Let's start with propaganda. As you may know, the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in a global propaganda campaign. One goal is to promote a positive view of China and its happy-go-lucky authoritarian regime. If that doesn't work, then their goal is censorship, to marginalize and suppress critical voices, like mine, and maybe yours. The Chinese regime spends $10 billion a year on overseas propaganda. That includes things like all-expense-paid red carpet trips to China for politicians and journalists. I'm going to guess those tours don't include labor camps. Their propaganda budget also goes to paying Western media companies, like the New York Times and Fairfax, to put articles from Chinese state-run media in their own newspapers and on their websites, which apparently is legal. The party also buys up Chinese language media in Australia and around the world. They want to make sure they report correctly on the party's benevolent rule. But propaganda doesn't end with the media. A key part of the Communist Party's influence operations is the United Front Work Department. Remember that name, because we'll be coming back to it a lot. The United Front is a top-level branch of the Communist Party. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has called it the Communist Party's magic weapon. He's a big Lord of the Rings fan. How magical is this weapon? Here's one example. There's a group linked to the United Front called the China-United States Exchange Foundation. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars last year lobbying Congress about U.S.-China relations. According to Foreign Policy magazine, the group also cooperates on projects with influential U.S. think tanks, like the Brookings Institution and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. These think tanks can have a big impact on U.S. policy making. And a group linked to the Chinese Communist Party is working with them to shape how the West views the Chinese Communist Party. But if the all-expense-paid trips and state-run articles and pro-Communist Party policy papers don't work, then there's the other side of the propaganda coin, censorship. And in the West, the Communist Party relies on applying just enough pressure to encourage self-censorship. The Chinese Communist Party has a list of topics they don't want discussed. Among the most sensitive are Tibet, Taiwan independence, and the Falun Gong spiritual group. So, what happens if you touch China in these sensitive zones? overseas Chinese journalists have had their families back in China threatened. Scholars have been denied research visas. Western journalists have been kicked out of China. It doesn't always happen, but it happens just enough to make people hesitate to cover these topics. I'm sure many of you have heard of the book Silent Invasion by Professor Clive Hamilton. It discusses in detail the ways the Chinese Communist Party has been infiltrating Australia. But Hamilton's original publisher, Allen and Unwin, scrapped the book. Censoring a book about Chinese censorship would not be the best idea. Hamilton's book was eventually released earlier this month by another publisher, Hardy Grant, showing that self-censorship does have its limits. Besides propaganda, the Communist Party's unrestricted warfare is also carried out through exploiting Western economic interests. The United Front also plays a role here. In January, Clive Hamilton and researcher Alex Joski wrote about the United Front Work Department's influence in Australia. They said many leading figures in the Australian business community now serve as megaphones for Beijing's messaging to the Australian government and the wider public, and that the business community also fears the risk of retaliation when statements are made that Beijing does not like. Statements like, Taiwan is a country, or pandas are fat. One of the biggest problems for companies entering China is corporate espionage. For years, Western companies have been eager to get into the Chinese market. What they don't realize is that the Communist Party has a strategy. Why innovate when you can just steal other people's ideas? This is not something the party tries to hide. Intellectual property theft is literally written into their national economic plan. In 2007, they released a document called the National Technology Transfer Promotion Plan. They might as well call it How to Steal and Not Get Caught. Here's how it works. Chinese military hackers steal a company's intellectual property and give it to a technology transfer center. They reverse engineer the technology and give it to Chinese businesses. Then those businesses make cheaper Chinese knockoffs of those Western products. That's what happened to an Australian company, Coden. One of their major products is metal detectors. ASIO discovered that a Coden employee's laptop was hacked during a business trip in China. Blueprints of the company's metal detectors were stolen, and cheap Chinese knockoffs flooded the market, still carrying the Coden logo. But the Coden CEO said the Australian government was unwilling to help since, at the time, a free trade agreement with China was on the line. The company had to cut its prices in half. In 1 year, their net profits fell from $45 million to $9 million. Apparently, the free trade agreement is China takes your stuff for free. But don't worry. Last year, Australia and China reached a deal. No more cyber intellectual property theft. And while they were shaking hands on it, China stole Australia's watch. So, how much do companies lose? Trillions. According to information security company Black Ops Partners, U.S. companies and the U.S. economy lose approximately $5 trillion each year, or over 30% of the U.S. GDP, to Chinese intellectual property theft. In addition to corporate espionage, the party uses infrastructure investment, like the One Belt, One Road initiative. On the surface, it's about building massive infrastructure projects around the world with the goal of facilitating global trade. Last year, Chinese leader Xi Jinping pledged to spend $124 billion on the plan. In the West, the Communist Party uses One Belt, One Road for both economic gain and political leverage. Take the case of Greece. Chinese state investment in Greek infrastructure has skyrocketed over the past several years. Power grids, major ports, telecommunications, actually in areas very similar to Australia. 2 years ago, after a controversial court ruling on the South China Sea, Greece coincidentally sided with the Communist Party. They were one of only two EU countries to do so. Well, two countries plus Sam Dastyari. We'll get to him in a moment. Last June, in another move that had totally nothing to do with the Chinese Communist Party's investments, Greece stopped the EU from condemning human rights abuses in China. The party's investments in Greece and other European countries have worried the EU, enough that they now want to screen Chinese investments that threaten national security, things like investing in power grids, major ports, and telecommunications. Using infrastructure investments and corporate espionage, the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare turns the West's economic interests against itself. Gaining political influence is another important tactic in China's unrestricted warfare. As I've heard repeatedly since coming here, Australia has the best politicians money can buy. ASIO has warned that foreign interference on an unprecedented scale has the potential to cause serious harm to Australia's sovereignty. Since 2015, ASIO has warned Australian politicians to be wary of taking money from Chinese donors with questionable links to the Chinese Communist Party. Thanks to some brilliant journalism from Fairfax Media, Four Corners, and others, we know the Chinese Communist Party has been very successfully buying influence in Australia. I also learned there are no laws against foreign campaign contributions here. Who thought that was a good idea? I mean, besides the politicians. Here's an example. Chinese billionaire Huang Xiangmo is linked to the United Front. The Fairfax and Four Corners report found that over 4 years, he donated $2.7 million to Australia's three biggest political parties. And he had some pretty unusual dealings with specific politicians. Of course, Huang Xiangmo's most well-known associate is Sam Dastyari. Huang gave Dastyari thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. Dastyari also got $1 million for the Labour Party from Huang. Now, we can't say for sure what Dastyari's motives were. But after that, Dastyari did some rather questionable things, like pressuring the Labour Foreign Affairs spokeswoman to not meet with a pro-democracy activist that Beijing doesn't like. And in a 2016 press conference to Chinese media, Dastyari contradicted his own party's stance on the South China Sea ruling, siding with the Chinese Communist Party instead. Oh, and when Dastyari found out Huang was being spied on by Australian security agencies, he personally went to Huang's mansion and warned him his phone was being tapped. Now that's real friendship. There are many other examples I could give of Australian politicians being bought off by the Communist Party, but I think you get the point. The book, Unrestricted Warfare, says social spaces such as the military, politics, economics, culture, and the psyche are also battlefields. And the Communist Party effectively uses the social spaces of Western universities. ASIO has warned the Australian government that it needs to be very conscious of foreign interference in Australian universities. And much of this interference comes, again, from the United Front, which calls overseas students a focus of United Front work. One example is the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, or CSSA. Most universities with large numbers of Chinese students have CSSAs. They're typically linked with the Chinese embassy, and their job is to make sure Chinese students toe the party line and to intimidate students who don't. Chinese students have found, in case that was important, I'm going to pick it up. All right. Where were we? Chinese students have found things they said in class in Australia were reported back to Chinese police by other Chinese students, which is why all of their term papers were titled Don't Free Tibet. The former head of the United Front, Liu Yandong, created the Confucius Institute for free. They'll set up classrooms to teach Chinese language and culture in universities. Since 2004, 500 Confucius Institutes have been set up in 140 countries. There are 14 institutes here in Australia. The Communist Party's former propaganda chief called the Confucius Institute an important part of China's overseas propaganda setup. So what exactly do they teach? Well, let's just say a little less Tiananmen Square massacre and a little more China's rapid economic development. But more and more, universities have been waking up to the nature of the Confucius Institute. Some universities have kicked them out, and currently the FBI is investigating them. In Australia, the Chinese Communist Party's influence in universities has become a national security issue. The Australian Research Council, using taxpayer money, has given millions of dollars in grants to Chinese professors working in Australia. The problem is, in some cases, these professors are doing research with the Chinese military.
on advanced military technology that could one day be used against the West. ARC has also given grants to universities for projects that involve China's leading military aircraft manufacturer and the telecommunications company Huawei, which also has ties to the Chinese military. And I thought allowing foreign campaign contributions was a bad idea. Is this a problem? Not according to UNSW's pro-vice chancellor, Lori Piercy. He also happens to be the head of the school's Confucius Institute. He wrote in a recent editorial called, he wrote a recent editorial called "Let's Not Isolate Ourselves from the Benefits of China." In it, he confidently states that Beijing respects the quality and independence of Australian institutions. Yes, Beijing respectfully undermines Australia's institutions. The Communist Party's unrestricted warfare has had a major impact on the West. The party uses propaganda to promote a glittering ideal of its rule, and censorship to silence opposition to it. It steals intellectual property from Western companies while using investment to get Western countries on its side. The party buys political influence wherever it can, however it can. It uses CSSAs and Confucius Institutes to stifle academic freedom at Western universities while taking advantage of research done there. Thus far, the West has been unprepared to counter the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare. So, what can be done? There are a few things. First, we need to understand the nature of the Chinese Communist Party. It's an authoritarian system that uses struggle to preserve and strengthen its rule. This will not change, no matter who's in charge, no matter what reforms are promised, no matter how open the economy appears to be. For those of us living in liberal democracies, it can be hard to understand the lengths the Communist Party will go to. We're not used to dealing with a government like this. As historian Frank Decotter said in Silent Invasion, it's like a Boy Scout dealing with Don Corleone. So I recommend we all rewatch The Godfather. Not that it will help with dealing with the party, it's just a good movie. Second, we need to expose the actions of the Chinese Communist Party. One of the biggest reasons the party has been able to carry out this unrestricted warfare is that people have remained silent through intimidation or self-interest. That's one reason why what's happening in Australia now is so vitally important. As I said earlier, Australia is one of the proving grounds for the Communist Party's tactics. But now, those tactics are being exposed, and people are openly talking about how to respond. The Communist Party is going to fight back. After the Fairfax and Four Corners investigation, the Chinese embassy called it filled with Cold War mentality and typical anti-China hysteria and paranoia. The party and those it has influenced will continue to cry racism and Cold War mentality to every legitimate concern. That's why we need to be very clear that these are the Chinese Communist Party's infiltration operation. It's not about racism against ordinary Chinese Australians. They're the ones who are the first targets of the party. The party wants us to believe they represent all Chinese people. If you're against the party, you're against the Chinese people. But don't fall for it when people play the racism card. We need to clearly distinguish between the party and Chinese people. This way, we both avoid racist undertones and demolish a key part of the Communist Party's propaganda. Third, we need to stand up to the Communist Party. Like most bullies, they tend to back down when confronted. The foreign interference laws being debated in Parliament are a good start. Australia could also lessen their economic reliance on the Chinese Communist Party by strengthening ties with other countries. Australia, the US, India, and Japan are in talks now to establish an alternative to China's One Belt, One Road initiative. Australia is not alone. The US, the EU, and other Western countries are also beginning to wake up to the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted warfare. Yes, Australia is on the front lines. But if these tactics can be defeated here, it will send a message to the Communist Party. The West is not for sale. Thank you for your time. I'll now take questions.
So many thanks to our speaker. We'll come to questions and discussion. And we've got some cameras, microphones here, one at each end. So we'll be underway. Let's start off. Look, at the Sydney Institute, as you may or may not know, we hear all sorts of views, and it's interesting to hear your view. But as a long-time opponent of the Chinese Communist Party all the way back to 1966, when I was one of the few Australian students who openly opposed the Cultural Revolution. I think China's influence here is less now than it was then, because it's not being peddled by Australian intelligentsia, it's being peddled by outside. I mean, when Mao died in Australia, the parliament stopped and had a condolence motion. That wouldn't happen with the current Chinese leader. Can I just make one brief point? I'd like your response. I think your thesis is essentially compelling, but it's exaggerated. I mean, I think to come here and say that China takes Australia's stuff for free is a gross exaggeration. I mean, they buy our minerals and our rural produce and our services at market prices. They buy them because they're good quality. And to say that Australia has the best politicians money can buy is simply offensive and not true. And if you just look at the Chinese embassy in Australia in recent times, they've criticised the Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, the Minister for the South Pacific Senator Pfefferanti Wells, and in recent times the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, because only this weekend we had the ASEAN meeting down here in Sydney, and the ASEAN group is not particularly pro-China. So what I'm saying is, whilst I accept you're making a number of very important points, I think it is important not to exaggerate and not to make hyperbolic points that can't be proven. Hang on, just a minute. Hang on, just a minute. Yep, response. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
May I grab my water real quick?
Thank you.
So, you should make a very good point about, for example, the minerals and the mining. One of the things people always say is how much power China, the Chinese Communist Party, has over Australia. But as you mentioned, China wants Australian minerals. This is an incredibly powerful leverage Australia has over the Communist Party. So this is a great source of strength for the country. The only thing that struck me also is when you talked about the condolence motion for Mao. That's very good. That was voted down. I know.
No, it wasn't. It was passed.
It was passed.
And well, it was moved by the Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser and seconded by the opposition leader Gough Whitlam in September 1976, and only six people dissented. So it was passed. What I'm saying, it would never happen now.
No. I hope not. I do think about how, in the United States, in New York, the Empire State Building, or here the Sydney Opera House, it has been draped in red, celebrating important communist holidays in China. So there is an odd level of support for a very bloody regime. But, you know, this is a very scary thing to be faced with. So I hope it's not as serious as you say. All evidence coming out currently is suggesting potentially otherwise.
Now, Shelley wanted
to... I was just interested in how you felt about ASIO, what ASIO had to say about China's influence here, given what you said about 1966.
Well, I didn't get a chance to pass the microphone. Shelley just raised the issue of what... I'm not the speaker here, so I'm bowing out now. About what I thought about ASIO. I mean, I think ASIO is doing a terrific job. And I think it's important to remember that there is ASIO. There's a Foreign Investment Review Board, there's ASIS. And the head of the Foreign Affairs Department recently expressed deep concern about Chinese influence in Australian universities. So there are a lot of Australians making important points about this now. Right, who's next? There's a question down here. Where?
Are you going to select questions? Or?
Yeah, no, I am. Okay. Can you take the mic? I can't.
What are your opinions on Xi Jinping's... extension of his reign.
Oh, can you just come back?
Yes, sure.
Speak into the mic.
In case you didn't hear, I was asked about Xi Jinping's extending his term. Mm. I'm very happy about that because I predicted it 2 years ago, so this is just a very good occasion for me. 2 years ago, I said Xi Jinping will definitely expand his term limits to what I said was he'll become not quite a president, not quite a dictator, more of a presitator. So feel free to use that term from now on. It's my gift to the Australian people. So to give a little more detailed answer, Xi Jinping has been, you know, I said the Communist Party has a culture of struggle. That includes Communist Party members struggling against each other. Xi Jinping has been engaged in a very brutal power struggle within China. And when I say the system is just inherently corrupt, this is what it leads to. Xi Jinping has to struggle to maintain his grip on power because there's millions of more Communist Party members who would love to knock him down a peg. This, unfortunately, was not really that shocking of a development. It was in the waters a while ago. Thank you.
Question here.
You consistently use the phrase unrestricted warfare, mm-hmm. which has a military connotation. Mm-hmm. What do you regard or anticipate would be seen by the Chinese Communist Party as a victory in this unrestricted warfare?
Oh, it's... Victory would be if no one ever criticizes how the Communist Party runs China, or nobody criticizes how it interacts with other countries. Across the world, China is making economic investments that are geared towards influencing the politics of other countries, as you saw with Greece. The goal is for China to become the primary superpower of the world and to be the primary influence.
Question up there?
Yes.
Chris,
yes.
There's two things with China that I've noticed in the lifetime, and that is the Chinese Communist Party, which our academics bend over backwards to rationalise as being okay for Chinese people in the 1970s. But then there's this mystery of China that seems to enchant people, like Paris enchants, or the French enchant people, that they seem to get away with doing things because people have this feeling that, you know, that they are somehow different and special and mysteriously wonderful. What about this love affair with all things China? I mean, there is, I think it's more than just the Chinese Communist Party and the way they're doing business. It's also this Western fascination with China. Why?
Well, this is something I touch upon in the speech. Traditional Chinese culture, there is something magic about it. That's why the entire world, for the entire history of humanity, has been so enchanted by China. There is so much the West can learn from traditional Chinese culture, and vice versa. Unfortunately, the Communist Party is able to leverage this now. After spending so many decades trying to wipe out traditional Chinese culture, it now is using it as a way to manipulate the West. It wants people to see, you know, the beautiful temples that a few decades ago were destroyed by the Communist Party, but now they've rebuilt them. And they want the West to see this and think, oh, this is China. It's these beautiful temples. And that is so appealing to people because there is magic to it. But it's now being used as essentially a weapon of unrestricted warfare.
Thanks. Historically in the world, power waxes and wanes, including superpowers. What do you feel would be the key elements in that happening in 30, 50, 100 years' time?
Sorry, what will happen in...
In 50 or 100 years' time, waxing and waning.
It would contribute to China not being how you paint it.
Yeah. So one thing I did not have a chance to go into in the speech is a lot of the internal turmoil the Communist Party is facing. A simple example, the Chinese Communist Party sees economic prosperity as the cornerstone to its rule. That's how it legitimizes its rule of the Chinese people. Don't have free speech, you can't have unions, but you might get rich, so don't argue. But you see these cracks forming in the Chinese economy, very bad cracks. Things like a real estate bubble, bad debt, shadow banking, capital flight, rich Chinese millionaires and billionaires taking their money out of China and coming around the world. Some have chosen Australia to settle in. And I mean, that's because they know the system is fundamentally unstable. Now, the Communist Party has proven remarkably capable of temporary short-term fix, putting duct tape on the cracks of the economy to keep the whole economy afloat. How long they can do that for before the short-term solutions stop working and the cracks burst open and it all sinks? People have been wondering that for a long time. They've been very good at keeping afloat. So that the Communist Party itself even talks about the severe challenges they're facing right now.
Do you feel that Shanghai's Sam Dastyari should have been attacked more in the media for being complicit with the Chinese Communist Party?
Ah, gosh, I would say from what I read, it was very thorough. It was very thorough.
That's all I just... the Labour Party.
Well, I don't want to be a foreign force meddling in the eternal affairs of the Australian nation.
That's a good one. Where do we go next? There's a question here. Just speak up. Yep.
Thanks.
No, we'll leave it. We'll take this one here, and then we'll come down to you. Yes, yes.
Okay. Historically, the Western democracies have put up the barriers with dictators and communist regimes. Where did the West go wrong with China opening up all the markets in China, knowing that it was run by a very strict communist regime? So where did it all start to go wrong?
That is a big topic that could be a speech of itself. To just give a fairly simple answer, once the Soviet Union collapsed, I feel the West sort of thought it was over. And China obviously at the time was still, I mean, there was a Tiananmen Square massacre. That was fresh in everyone's mind for many years. And so using the U.S. as an example, many politicians criticized the Chinese regime. Bill Clinton, when he was running for office, called them the butchers of Beijing. And yet, we saw that when he became president, he was responsible for, you know, making China a member of the WTO and opening up trade with China. And I'd like to be optimistic and say that it was because people genuinely thought that if you have economic opening up, democratization will naturally follow. That unfortunately has not proven to be the case.
So was it a mistake?
Well, it certainly hasn't helped. I should say it's good that Chinese people are not starving like they were during the Cultural Revolution, obviously. A prosperous China is great. China has always been powerful, and that is not a bad thing. The problem is the Chinese Communist Party. People often talk about a free Tibet. People should talk about a free China.
There's a question here.
You mentioned that China has indicated itself within its own talk, most itself, that China faces some severe problems. And one of the problems that I see as a sort of economic type person to a degree is the amazing growth of China and the fact that their GNP seems to go up by around 6.5% within 0.1 or 0.2. No other nation in the world seems to be able to do this. They report these figures within about a week of the end of each quarter. And I'm just wondering what you think of how they can do this amazing Houdini stunt.
Well, I mean, obviously I can't have magical insight into the Chinese economy, so I'll just use the words of the Chinese premier, Li Keqiang. In a U.S. embassy cable that was leaked, he said the economic data from China is man-made and therefore unreliable. So, I'll let him answer that question. Thank you. Yes.
You mentioned racism has been used quite extensively in recent months to sort of downplay what has been happening with the infiltration and the influence of the Chinese Communist Party. Are there elements or parts of the Chinese community who are actually supporting the non-racist arguments, or those who are actually not so in favour of the Chinese Communist infiltration? There are people who actually don't like what the Chinese Communist Party is doing amongst the Chinese themselves.
That's a very good question. So, for example, last week I was at the book launch for Clive Hamilton's Silent Invasion. Most of the people there were from the Chinese community. average Chinese people, Tibetans, Falun Gong practitioners. They are. I actually did an interview with John Hugh, and he had some very interesting insights. He feels that if the Chinese community doesn't stand up to this now, then there is a risk for the Chinese Australian community. They know they are the many in the Chinese community understand they are the first victims of what the Communist Party is doing, and many of them stand up to it. Over the years, you can see the protests launched by Tibetans, by Falun Gong practitioners, often which are shouted out by large groups of, well, wherever those people come from. But so that is an example of how their voices are being silenced in Australia, which should not be acceptable, that in a democratic society, people have the right to speak, especially the marginalized and the oppressed. And it's unacceptable that these groups can't have their voices heard.
Question here.
Questions. Have you been to China? When was the first one? When was the last one?
Oh, I went to the Scarborough Shoal part of China. I've been to the Taiwan part of China and the Hong Kong part of China and Macau. Mainland China I haven't entered because, well, I don't know how wise of an idea that would be. For me, people who go to China, well, so for example, all of the journalists around the world who get all expenses paid trips to China, often they see a very different side of China. An American professor I know made a very good point. He told me, people judge a country based on their hotels. China has very nice hotels. Thank you.
Yeah, we just got to follow up here.
Oh, yes.
I have to say, China doesn't have a Western hotel until very late.
Sorry?
The suggestion is that China hasn't had a Western hotel until very late.
Oh.
Until 1980.
So, okay.
I think it's 1980.
I would love to visit.
Okay, I think, there's a question here.
I have two questions. Firstly, about Japan. Japan and China had a very complicated relationship.
That's a light way to put it.
And the first question is, how do you see China's attempts in the areas you described in your talk in Japan? And secondly, how do you evaluate the performance of the current U.S. administration in countering these issues you talked about?
So Japan and the U.S. The situation in Japan is slightly different from the Western world because of the absolutely horrible atrocities the Japanese military has committed against the Chinese. World War II... the government of China at the time.
Okay.
Well, so, essentially after the Communist Party won World War II, as they say. Oh, yeah, you didn't know. The war to resist Japanese aggression, they call it. So the Communist Party has used these feelings of national resentment towards specifically the Japanese as a rallying cry to unify the Chinese people. So that is a very different relationship than they have with other Western powers. This has proved to be a little bit of it's a hard dragon to ride because sometimes anti-Japanese riots have gotten so bad in China, even the Chinese police could not control it. So that's why I say the situation, the relationship with Japan is a little more, it's different.
Okay, now we're going to move on. So there's a question.
Afterwards.
Well, there's a question here.
Just here.
Here we go.
It's on. I think.
What can Australian society do to better support the Chinese groups? Or, I guess, turn that around. Mm. What is American society doing to better support Chinese groups?
Okay. Any society, they need to speak up. Unrestricted warfare works in the context when people don't know what's happening. Mm. since it can't be overtly aggressive, otherwise it just becomes normal warfare. So what can Australian or American society do? One, they need to make it, they need to speak up, and when they do that, they need to make it very clear that they're targeting the Chinese Communist Party and not the Chinese people. That is fundamental. Past that, you know, it's a democracy. People can write to their politicians, vote for politicians who believe in what they believe. People can themselves run for office and make the change they want to see happen. Those are the biggest things.
I think earlier there was a double-barrel question. I think there was a question there as well about your attitude to the Trump administration and its position on China.
Yes. One thing I noticed that was very different about the Trump administration versus previous administrations is all presidential candidates, they talk a hard game against China, and then they come into office, and then they don't always follow through with what they say. Trump talked a very tough game against China. He has been, he's it's President Donald Trump. He does many things. He goes to China, or he has Xi Jinping over, and they have the best chocolate cake ever. And then he'll launch an airstrike on Syria while he's meeting with Xi Jinping. Or he'll go to Beijing and be the first foreign leader to be in the Forbidden Temple. And they seem like they have a great time, and then he talks about tariffs. I would say there's more he could do. There's always more that U.S. presidents could have done. Actually, in the U.S., I feel the legislative branch has been very good about standing up to China. The judicial branch has been very good about, say, for instance, providing refugee to people fleeing the Communist Party. I'd say the presidential, the executive branch of the U.S. government could do more. And that is true for any of the previous U.S. presidents.
You said that the end, you kind of detailed the end game for the unrestricted warfare from the Chinese perspective before. What's the end goal from the Western perspective? How do we win? What's the victory?
Again, it requires standing up. Unrestricted warfare does not work if people know about it and stand up to it. And as you mentioned, Australia has a lot of power over natural resources and mining. The Communist Party is not this giant monolith that you can't fight. The Australian society has so much to offer. I've certainly enjoyed my time here. People from China should be drawn to this country. So how can the West win? Talk openly about it and make it clear. Understand the nature of the Chinese Communist Party, understand how it lies, and understand that the Chinese Communist Party is not the Chinese people.
There's a question up there.
Yes. Do you see domestic fissures in China causing a breakup of the country at some point in the future, given that power is in the hands of people who run major companies or major government instrumentalities with a million employees and things like that, and they may not be desirous of having their power completed?
Well, no one who has power wants to lose that power. All I can say is that that is a possibility. It's hard to say exactly what will happen. The Communist Party itself talks about how China is facing unprecedented challenges. So these are very interesting times for China, definitely. It's hard to predict exactly what could happen. And how the West responds to unrestricted warfare will play a critical role in that.
So we're getting close to the end. There's a question up there.
What you were saying about the theft of intellectual property is interesting, because it would have been 10 years ago, Jared and I had a meeting with a very senior US official, and that was exactly what the US was worried about. With all the technology that is available to the Western world, whether it be from Israel to the US, whatever, why has it been so hard to stop this kind of highway robbery?
Well, being unguarded, I think, is the biggest issue. I can't remember what specifically was hacked, but there was an instance where the Chinese Communist Party conducted a major hack against the U.S. government, and the reason they were able to get in, I think, was because somebody forgot to update the software. So it's simple things like that. And also, Western companies have just been so blinded by the prospects of the Chinese market that they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. Actually, a lot of Western companies have struggled in China because they got in under former Chinese leaders who are political opponents of the current Chinese leader, and it's not a situation like in the U.S. where, you know, a business could come in under Bill Clinton and be fine under President Trump. If you get into China under former leader Jiang Zemin, you are believed to have a guanxi, a relationship with him. And so when a new leader comes who is not on his side, that means you can be in trouble. And many Western companies found themselves dealing with their offices in China being ransacked, being hit with fines. So it's not being guarded.
Right, second last question. You've got to be brief.
Very briefly. Should Confucius Institutes be closed?
She answered it for me, yes. That's her. That's why many schools have kicked them out.
Just background the Confucian Institute. So just give us I know you did in your speech, okay. But we're talking about very briefly what.
Okay. The Confucius Institute was set up by the former head of the United Front Department. It's been called a crucial part of China's propaganda efforts. They offer universities around the world free Chinese language programs and culture programs. So that's very tempting for universities strapped on cash, but they spread party propaganda, essentially. And because of that, they're very dangerous. Very dangerous.
So final question. You're not quite the Confucius Institute. You don't have that sort of money behind you. But it is quite an achievement for an individual to set up something that sort of lasts. I mean, last means 2, 3, 4, 5 years or more. So tell us about how you came to set up China Uncensored and how it now works. I mean, we see a bit of you on YouTube here, but we don't see you on cable television.
Well, I would love to be on cable television in Australia. If anyone knows how to make that happen, I'm all for it. So I've been blown away by the support people have given to China Uncensored over the years. I feel very passionately about China because I love the country and I love the culture, but I saw what the Communist Party was doing and not a lot of people noticed or cared. So I thought creating a show that uses humor to kind of sweeten the dagger a little bit, make it not so horrific, would be a good way to reach people, and it has succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. People have really resonated with this. I get letters from people in China, particularly Chinese students who come abroad, watch my show, and have their eyes open, and they'll send me a letter thanking me for it, and that is mind-blowing to me. And then they still watch it in China. Don't tell the Communist Party. So a lot of love has come from viewers. Since you ask about how it's supported, it's supported by viewers of the show. It's entirely a viewer-supported show. So that's just, I think, a testament to how passionate people are becoming about China. And I've been very happy that my audience, for the most part, is very clear about the distinction between the Communist Party and the Chinese people. That's something I always hit, and most of the people I encounter now share my love of Chinese culture and less love of the Communist Party.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
So thanks to Chris Chappell for coming along tonight and talking about China's growing influence in the West. As I said, it's quite an achievement to set up something like China Uncensored and keep it going, so good luck. In thanking you, I should recall a recent speaker we had here on two occasions, Harry Wu, who spent 20 years in the Chinese labour camps from the late 50s through into the 70s. Spoke for us on a couple of occasions, died recently a very, very brave and noble man, a brave man who I think we all should remember. But tonight, look, it was a controversial talk. It was lively. It was there were points we could challenge. But the Sydney Institute were all about debate. But I'm very pleased you came along and stated your case eloquently and with conviction. We like people with conviction here. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.